6:05 here on a Friday. It's good to have you, Lloyd, with the day off. Jamie will join us later on in the show. So you and I are driving to work together this morning. It's good to have you. You know, I've got an interesting question for you coming up at 6:35. And as we approach, you know, here in Michigan, at the very minimum, our primary coming up here in just a couple of months, I have an important question for you about how you spend your money around this time of a political cycle. We'll get to it at 6:35. But while J.D. Vance is out not only promoting his book, but trying to sell this memorandum of understanding to you, I think one thing that I find very fascinating is this new book by Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan of the New York Times, because they describe this tension between Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance after the strikes on the nuclear facilities in Iran. According to an excerpt, the president was frustrated that the vice president did not use his preferred phrasing that Iran's program had been, quote, totally obliterated, instead choosing more cautious language that, you know, it was a setback to the program. Not totally obliterated, but setback. And there was apparently, according to this book, some pressure to focus in on the messaging. Now, again, taking you behind the curtain, this is not uncommon, where you've got, whether it's presidents, whether it's specific secretaries, whatever it is, when it comes to an issue, everybody wants to be on the same page. And there is a difference between the two. I was just watching yesterday an interesting podcast. It's called Diary of a CEO, and it's this young, now retired CEO of a company. And he interviews fascinating people, and he had J.D. Vance on the show. And one of the things that J.D. Vance had said in this particular episode was that, you know, he and the president have very different styles. And while the president can be a little more boisterous, the president can you know, color things a certain way, that's not generally how he operates. And so this particular excerpt of this book shows that there is a difference in how they approach these issues. And again, taking you back a little bit further, J.D. Vance was critical of this operation. J.D. Vance was not on board with going into Iran, particularly because of some of the things that they had said during the campaign. Some of the things that Donald Trump had said in his first term as president of the United States. Also, a series of phone calls from a concerned mother in Ohio is what helped authorities uncover this alleged plot to attack the UFC event held at the White House. That's according to ABC News. The woman became alarmed by her 19-year-old son's behavior. She had concerns about weapons and ammunition and his mindset, and contacted a relative in law enforcement and local dispatchers. Deputies were sent to the home, where the mother reported that she had removed guns and ammunition from her son's room and wanted the situation documented, which helped trigger this wider investigation. That trip to that mother's house ultimately led federal authorities to identify what they are saying was a broader, coordinated plan involving multiple suspects that were potentially tied to this event. And her son is Tyson Proper, and he's been charged with serious federal offenses, conspiracy and firearms crimes, and several others have been taken into custody in this case. But it's the, if you see something, say something. If something doesn't feel quite right, you got to come out and say something. And this mother did, and that may have been the springboard to uncovering this. But you're talking about drones carrying explosives into the grounds, and then snipers waiting nearby to pick people off as they were frantically running away. Thankfully, that was thwarted. How about this, too? This is unbelievable. So yesterday, we told you about Luigi Mangione. Of course, he's accused of killing CEO Brian Thompson of United Healthcare back in 2024. We had heard that they were going to use a psychiatric defense in his murder trial in New York State. And now they're dropping it. They said that they were going to highlight this experience of extreme emotional disturbance when he allegedly shot Thompson, but then they reversed course in a court filing. And the decision, it does change the strategy, I think, from his legal team pretty significantly. A psychiatric defense would have required Mangione to concede that, yes, he killed Brian Thompson. And as a result of that, they would have potentially lowered the conviction from murder to manslaughter. But with now that option on the table, Mangione is still pleading not guilty. And now this is going to go to trial in September. Also, fascinating story. When we were up on Mackinac Island for the Mackinac Policy Conference, I guess I hadn't been up there in a couple of years. And there were police officers, of course, on bikes. And as we were in one of the carriages heading downtown from the Grand Hotel, there was a police officer standing behind a light post with a speed gun in his hand. I had never seen that before. Well, this law went in 2024, and it's a law that limits bike speeds for people on the island to 15 miles an hour and then 10 miles an hour in like downtown Mackinac, right there on the water. And it hasn't been actively enforced yet, according to a story in the, I believe this was the Detroit News. Police say they haven't issued citations specifically under the new law because, well, they say that there is, most people ride their bikes fine on Mackinac Island, but they continue to rely on reckless driving and unsafe operation rules to manage dangerous driving behavior on the island.
I haven't ridden the bike in 50 years.
Okay.
Do they have speedometers on them? Unless I'm really just bearing down and trying to go fast, how do I know how fast I'm going?
Brian, these were some of the questions that we also were answering.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. You don't want somebody going as fast as they can through, downtown Mackinac.
Well, people get a couple of pops. It's busy down there.
Exactly.
You don't want that.
You're going to hurt yourself and others.
Absolutely.
But how do you know? How fast you were going? I don't. It's a bike.
Yeah. I know. It's absolutely wild. This story is also interesting, too, because it does highlight the change in college athletics. And this comes out of the University of Michigan. Ward Manuel, the athletic director, says the school is exploring new ways to generate revenue, including in-stadium advertising, and corporate patches on jerseys. And this would help fund NIL programs. In a letter to fans, Emmanuel says that Michigan is looking at highly visible but thoughtfully integrated options, such as field logos, scoreboard ads, sponsorships, and uniform patches to help fund all 29 sports and remain competitive in the NIL front. Michigan Stadium has traditionally been kept advertising free. And I remember it was, 2000 and I want to say 14, when Dave Brandon put out this Coca-Cola promotion. You were able to get tickets to a game by buying a bottle of Coca-Cola. The two tickets with a face value of $150, you could get that for the $3 Coke. And people lost their minds.
Why?
And because that's not generally how Michigan is operated.
Well, I understand that. That's not advertising on the field. That's more like a contest.
Right, but you were basically, the value of your ticket was going down significantly.
I suppose, or I'm giving you free tickets for buying a Coke.
And you don't watch, so no. You don't know, but...
No, but it
in
does.
College football, when they pull the nets up, when there's a field goal or an extra point attempt,
right,
there's that net there.
Mm-hmm.
And the net at Michigan Stadium forever, up until a few years ago, were just regular nets.
Yeah.
Well, now, if you watch a game, they superimpose the All-State Good Hands logo on it. And now, that even angered some fans.
Yeah, but is that a TV thing or is that a...
But the point is, Michigan, the Michigan Blue Bloods, the people that are, that have been going to these games for years and years and years, don't want any of it. But the question is, would you rather have that and be able to, buy some players down the road? Or do you want to maintain the integrity of
I thought the idea of
your
college
history?
Football was to lure the best people to you by having the best academic you know, a curriculum you could give for them and give them a good education. Now it's just become, it feels like it's just professional football now. You're going to pay them to be there and advertise. Why are we even, what's the difference?
You're such a sweet, sweet, innocent boy, Brian.
Well, and there's a difference in TV advertising and them advertising. You know, if the, sure, the TV puts Allstate in the net, okay, that's a TV thing, whatever. If U of M's doing it, then I could see getting really mad if, you know, and I do understand that. I wouldn't want advertising on the field either.
Interest rates staying tight. Patrick Anderson joins us on the other side. It's JR Morning. All right, so Federal Reserve Chair Kevin Warsh followed the script, essentially, on what he was going to do with the benchmark, and he decided to keep those interest rates steady. No drop, no rise, although the inflationary number is rising. And what does that signal? Is that an indicator on who Kevin Warsh is or how he's going to look at this? Or are there still moves to be made? Patrick Anderson's the principal and CEO of the Anderson Economic Group and joins us this morning. Patrick, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chris.
What did you make of that decision? I mean, it did not seem surprising based on what we've seen with that inflation number the last couple of months.
I welcome not only the decision by the Federal Open Market Committee, but also the statement by the new chair and the fact that it was unanimous. All of this goes to underline what I was hoping would happen and appears to have happened. We have a good person now running the Fed, a person that's firmly committed to price stability, firmly committed to an independent Fed. And they made the only decision they could with the data, but they did it in, let me say, high style for the Fed, which is saying it directly, saying it with near unanimity, and saying it in a way that was unambiguous. The Fed seems to be back in business of trying to hold the line on inflation. As much pressure as this Federal Reserve chairman has gotten and the past one's gotten about to immediately cutting rates, they seem on mission and they seem united on it. So I welcome what they did.
There didn't seem to be any sort of dissenting opinions on federal funds targeting that 3.5%, 3.75%. But some of the inclinations on what I've read shows that there could be a hike later this year.
There could be. And if we have, we continue to have oil prices go up, if we continue to have inflation creeping up, then the general Fed policy should be to raise rates later this year. But I'm hopeful we don't. I mean, we have a memorandum of understanding and with the Iran war, that's not the end of the war, but it is a memorandum of understanding. So it's progress, much less uncertainty. Oil prices are down. There's a lot of improvement in terms of the geopolitical uncertainty, economic uncertainty, and the U.S. economy is fundamentally strong. So I think there's a good chance that we'll have the economy get better, inflationary prices drop, inflationary pressures drop, and we won't need an increase, or maybe we need just a small one.
One of the things that I was that did stick out to me was his usage of the term price stability. And he has been pretty bullish on this idea of cutting rates, but that's a bit of a different approach than what I was expecting to hear from him.
I thought he did that in, as I said, high style. And you rarely hear the word style and Federal Reserve.
Right. Those usually don't go hand in hand.
Right. But if you are a central banker, that was a tour de force performance in letting people know you meant price stability. You meant every word of it. You meant price. You meant stability. You meant price stability. He did a great job at that. And I'll compliment the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. We got at least two other people from Michigan on that committee, mm-hmm. By the way, that were playing a role. So it's definitely the Fed doing their job. I know that meant that some of the Wall Street folks that wanted a hint of a rate cut are disappointed, but we have a lot more resting on whether the United States currency is sound and whether we can keep inflation under control than we have about short-term rate cuts.
You mentioned oil prices. That's obviously playing a big role here. I'm curious to know, Because things are not like flipping a switch. It's not like all of a sudden, because there's a memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran, that prices are going to come down. But people have been feeling a lot of downward pressure, especially as that inflationary number has ticked up slightly. Where do you think the relief comes at this point as we sit here in mid-June? Mid-June.
And Chris, you're right. If you look at oil, just signing a memorandum of understanding doesn't fill up all the coffers that have been heavily drained, but it pretty much is moving tankers right away. And that is a more crisis situation in some parts of Europe and Asia. The United States, to our great success here, I mean, it's been a real success for the United States to improve its own energy situation through fracking, through expansion of exploration for oil here. So the U.S. has been heavily insulated, but not completely insulated from this. And it's not just the price of gas. Fertilizer, particularly for Michigan's agriculture industry, very important. Diesel fuel goes into almost everything. And for those that are heating their homes or maybe driving an electric car, guess what? Fossil fuels are important for that too. Natural gas prices. So all those things have been affected. They've been pushing up prices, and they've been unsettling consumers and taking away some of American paychecks and crimping budgets. So it was definitely something that affected us. And a memorandum of understanding, a cessation of hostilities,
right,
letting tankers go. I think all that is going to be positive, just as the president, the vice president, and every economist has said.
Patrick Anderson, appreciate your time as always. Thank you. We'll take a break. Would you do this? It's coming up. So I was reading a story the other day. Brian, let me ask you, how much money do you think are being spent on midterm election ads this cycle? If you had to guess.
I would guess probably, if not over, very close to $1 billion.
$1 billion.
I would imagine.
Sure. Okay. Well, it's actually almost $12 billion.
Oh, my God.
That's how much an ad intelligence company is projecting will be spent on the 2026 races. Almost $12 billion. Now, let me put that into perspective a little bit for you. If you made $100,000 a year, that's a good amount of money.
Yeah, very much so.
Solid income. You'd have to work for 120,000 years to earn $12 billion, which is longer than we know that humans have existed. Maybe if you spent $1,000 every day, right? I think most people could manage that, spending $1,000 every day.
Yeah. Having it, maybe not, but
it would take you 32,000 years to spend $1 billion. Okay. So we're talking about astronomical amounts of money. Now, here's where I think people will probably answer this question. If you're driving in your car on the way to work, if you are getting dressed this morning, if you're getting, you know, your kids breakfast, you probably will answer this differently than if I were to ask you in public or you were to talk about it at the water cooler. Which, by the way, do people have water coolers anymore? Do people gather around water coolers anymore?
I don't know if they ever gathered
around. I don't know that they ever did. It was probably like gathered around the coffee pot. Or the Keurig machine.
Absolutely.
I don't know anybody ever gathered around a water cooler. So my question to you is, with all of this money being spent, somebody's giving money to these campaigns. Have you ever donated to a political campaign? Or would you donate to a political campaign? Because I'm not just talking about, you know, liking a post or sharing a post on social media. I'm talking about getting your credit card out on purpose and entering in the numbers on a campaign website and clicking submit. Dollars that you work hard for, money that you actually work for, going towards a political campaign. Because I think there's different levels of buy-in. You can support a candidate by not contributing your money.
Yeah.
And then, but once you start contributing money, I mean, to me, you're on board. You are fully on board.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's an interesting question because there is a divide right now. And I think that has probably changed the way some people look at this. I don't think 20 years ago, it was as big of a deal. I don't think people necessarily thought about it. I don't think they would have, I don't think they would have batted an eye at even not donating. But now it's different. It's very, very tribal. No. And so you've got people that donate regularly. You have people that maybe give once. And then you have people that go, you're not getting a penny. Well, or a nickel. We don't have pennies anymore. A nickel of my money anymore. So where are you? Because you've got this, I think, to be an interesting perspective, because you are going to get big name people that are going to donate, right? Like the Elon Musks, for example. You're going to get the Silicon Valley folks to spend a lot of money. Traditionally, they've spent on Democrats. We did see a little bit of a change in that in the 2024 election. But businesses are going to donate. You know, high-profile people are obviously going to donate.
But don't you think there's a difference in Elon Musk is going to donate millions of dollars because he wants something if that guy wins?
Oh, sure.
As opposed to you and me, here's $25. I believe in what you say.
I think there is an absolute difference.
Yeah.
Yes, I think there is an absolute difference.
Yeah, so donating is one thing. Paying for favors, to me, is what most donations seem to be when they're on a large scale. And businesses do it both. They'll donate to Republicans and Democrats,
oh, sure,
so they're hedging their bet to
absolutely
make sure whichever side wins, I can be in favor.
Which is just a good business decision.
It is, truthfully. Also very mercenary.
I don't disagree, but that's the way it works. I no problem with that. But here's where I think it gets interesting, because I think a lot of people will say, Chris, I don't give to campaigns because I don't like the influence of money in politics. And I would say, yes, I totally agree. But does that then, to your point, give the special interests, give the big money spenders, does that just open it up for them? Because if you were to collect $100 from 10 people, or a company giving you $1,000, it's different, right? The feel is completely different. So I'm just curious if you have ever given to a campaign, why? And if you haven't, why? 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. You can call or text. I've never felt the need to donate to a political campaign.
Me neither. And
partly, you know, I'm in the media. This is what we do. I mean, I have people that'll knock on my door and ask me to fill out a survey or ask me polling questions. And I always say, no, I can't do that. I could, but I don't.
Right. I do the same thing.
And so that bleeds over into money. I don't contribute to political campaigns. Never have. I suppose I shouldn't say I never would. Because if somebody really came and blew my socks off, I would be compelled to contribute.
Yeah, never say never.
But I do think that there is, I mean, an element of it is, you know, you look at what's happening here now. Is one of the reasons Mike Duggan dropped out of the race was because he says the money wasn't there. And to be fair, he was an independent candidate. And that was, it's a difficult time to be an independent.
Right. You're not getting any of the party money.
Well, you're not getting any of the, I mean, traditionally you wouldn't get the party money, but as things have gotten so polarized,
correct,
there is more of a pool of people that would fall more towards that moderate independent side of things.
Yes.
And
but
so
you can't get money for that.
Well, but in Mike, well, you, I think you can. And I think Mike Duggan did, but what we've seen, particularly since this conflict with Iran started, was that the way all of that has played out, it was pushing people more towards the Democrats.
Yeah.
And so if you're in the middle and you're looking where to spend money and all the trends are not on the right or in the middle, but they're on the left, well, where are you going to spend your money?
Right.
You're going to spend your money. I'm not going to place a bet on the Preakness fourth place winner.
Yeah.
I'm trying Good to pick point. Who's going to finish the line across the line first.
Right, and traditionally anyway, in midterms, there's a flip in parties. Republicans carry
sure.
the day, and
for
then
sure.
the midterms, the Democrats would carry the day. So, yeah, and that's, you know, just, you're right. In an investment term, you're correct. But I think we think wrong nowadays about this stuff. We need to look at policies and who's the best candidate, not who has the most money and the coolest ads.
Well, and I told you, I mean, to me, one of the biggest problems with our political system is the influence of money.
Yeah.
And that's not only at the campaign level, but I mean, again, you've got people that sit on very powerful committees that have access to very important information. And all of a sudden they're buying $50,000 of stock in a company that they might have inside interest in,
right,
or inside knowledge of. It's a problem.
Yeah, public service is no longer serving the public. It's almost serving your own best interest.
I want to say it's the UK where they have a capped amount of money that they can spend on a campaign, and that's it.
Now, and it should be that way.
It should be, but we're babies out with the bathwater at this point.
Now, I went to the Netherlands a few years ago, and it was a campaign year for them. I saw their campaign ad. Nothing on TV, no TV ads, and there was one billboard in every town, right at the edge of town, and it was a huge billboard with everybody's little poster on it. If you wanted to see who was running, you had to get out of your car, walk over to the billboard, and look at all the little flyers, like 8x10 flyers.
Right.
That was it.
Right.
Nothing else. If you want, you had to figure out who to vote for.
We have a couple of texts rolling in. I would donate blood, but not for a campaign to have somebody lie to me. I thought social media was free, Rod from Plymouth said. And we have seen a lot of that. I mean, there has been a lot of
very much so
push towards social media, obviously.
And a lot of that is AI, so you have to be very careful with social media since it is free and everybody has access to it.
Coming up on the other side, we're going to talk about Thomas Jefferson as we continue our push on Founding Fathers Fridays. And a new book is out, The Declaration of Independence, A Radical Experience in Liberty. A very complicated life, Thomas Jefferson. We'll talk about it. It's next on JR Morning. One of the things I love about our founding fathers is obviously it's a complicated history. Obviously, there are a lot of wonderful things that they've done, and the ugly side of that era. But there maybe none were as consequential as Thomas Jefferson. And as we get ready for our 250th birthday of this grand experiment known as the United States of America, we're taking a look at some of those influential people back at the beginning, and how they played a role into what we are experiencing today. And today we focus on Thomas Jefferson. And Dr. Brad Berzer is a professor of history at Hillsdale College, an expert on Thomas Jefferson. And he just published a book, The Declaration of Independence, A Radical Experiment in Liberty. And Dr. Brad Berzer joins us. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you.
So much. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you could carve a couple of minutes for us this morning.
Absolutely.
I do want to talk about Thomas Jefferson because his early life is very different from, say, somebody like George Washington, where Washington wanted to ascend the British ranks and become a high-ranking officer. That wasn't Thomas Jefferson's bag necessarily.
Oh, that's right. He was very much a scholar, always from the beginning. And it's really beautiful to go back and look at what were called his commonplace books, which was the norm of the founders at the time. They would write down quotes, usually in whatever language they were reading. They would write their quotes down in these books, and they would serve as a kind of diary, but they were always about ideas. And Jefferson, really, from the beginning, he's a scholar, and he loves Cicero, and he loves Tacitus, he loves the Romans, and that's what he's really focused on.
There's so much about his life that I'd love to sit down with you for 2 hours and talk about it.
Sure.
I do want to bounce around a little bit, though, because one of the people that in my research over the years on these guys, one of the people that I came across was William Small. And this is somebody that you don't necessarily hear associated with Thomas Jefferson, but they met at William and Mary, at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. How did William Small have such a vast impact on Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah. People that had that kind of influence on him, and he really respected Small all of his life. Even when he went to France, he was still staying in contact with Small. And Small was very interesting on the issue of slavery because he was pretty anti-slavery. And so Jefferson was taken with that argument. And of course, we know it's complicated with Jefferson because nobody of his era tried more legally to abolish slavery, but while never abolishing his own slavery. So that's where Small fits in, having that kind of influence. But again, there were a couple of faculty that had really, really played a role in Jefferson's understanding of the world. And he was always deeply loyal to these men.
What did he accomplish when he was part of the legislature in Virginia? Because that was kind of the hierarchy of you own land, you're a tobacco farmer, and then all of a sudden you serve in the House of Burgess. What changed for him there?
Well, it's really where he became just a great writer, and was known. He did not like politics, and he did not like speaking out loud. He hated oration, but he loved writing. And so he was always given written assignments in the House of Burgesses, and he attained a reputation that way. Mostly, we know him because of what he wrote in 1774, and that was his summary view of the rights of Englishmen in America. And that's really where he gained his reputation. He was only 31 at the time, but that's where everybody else in America said, this guy is really important.
And then, of course, when he writes the Declaration of Independence, you know, there was some back and forth on a lot of the issues that he brought forward amongst other founding fathers, other members of that time. What was it that he was so steadfast in his belief in this writing?
Yeah, you know, the Declaration is so amazing, Chris, because when you look at something like we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, you know, outside of what we might find in Holy Scripture, this is one of the, if not the most important sentences in human history. And so when we think about someone like Thomas Jefferson, we have to recognize, again, whatever his faults, all of that is kind of trumped by what he did with the Declaration. What we find with the Declaration, though, is that Congress generally liked about 95% of what Jefferson wrote, and they adopted that. But they did make two really important changes. One, they took out Jefferson's condemnation of the slave trade, which was really important that they took that out. I mean, it was terrible that they took it out, but it really shaped the way the country would develop. And the other thing they did, which, you know, Jefferson was pretty deistic in his faith. He was skeptical about Christianity. But the other thing Congress did is they added that final line, we pledge our fortunes, our lives, and our sacred honor, right? And so they really make the Declaration a religious document in a way that Jefferson had not envisioned.
Well, and of course, the ugly side of it, his owning of people, again, common during that time, as horrendous as it was. But he had, obviously, we know of Sally, right? His kind of love interest, who was one of his slaves, had children as well. And that's a complicated part of his past.
Right. It's only speculation that they had that relationship. Okay. I think most historians would agree that he probably did have that relationship, but the DNA evidence is inconclusive. So we just don't know. We do know that he treated Sally, though, very differently than his other slaves. And she really became, especially after Jefferson lost his wife, Sally really became the mistress of the house and took care of things, especially when they were in France. She took care, and she was fluent in French. She was an incredible woman in and of herself, even though she was a slave. Really important person. But yeah, there's always that possibility that Jefferson had that relationship with her and then had children with her. We just don't know.
Really fascinating stuff. And can't wait to read your book, Dr. Brad Berzer. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah.
It was great talking, Chris.
Yes. We'll talk again very soon, I hope. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you got it. Fascinating stuff as we get ready for the 250th here in the United States. We'll take a break, 7 o'clock hour, get you caught up on some of the headlines. Also, polling shows that this is at an incredibly low number. We'll tell you what that is. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, it's JR Morning. All right, 7 o'clock hour, good to have you with us on a Friday. And here's your chance to win a trip to see Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire in the city of your choice. We've got your flights, hotel, concert tickets, and premium VIP lounge access covered. It's your chance to sing along all night long with Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire. Prizes provided by Live Nation. All you got to do is text this hour's national keyword VISION to 95819. That's V-I-S-I-O-N to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Play four times each weekday for four chances to win. Official rules and more info at WJR.com. Well, law enforcement officials had disrupted that plot to attack the UFC event at the White House over the weekend. And according to court papers unsealed this week, they say the conspirators discussed flying drones loaded with explosives over the event and then shooting people who were running away. Those five people that have been arrested across the country and charged with conspiracy to commit murder, among other counts, investigators recovered firearms and ammunition, encrypted text messages of 19 people suspected to have been a part of this plot. They shared maps and photos and talked about escape routes after the attack, and that investigation is ongoing. And some of those suspects are going to be in court. And this all started because an Ohio mother of one of the suspects uncovered this alleged plot and that her son was taking part in. She was obviously alarmed by this. She called police and they came to her home. They had removed guns and ammunition from her son's room. And she just wanted the situation documented, but that helped trigger this wider investigation. And that's federal authorities say that's what eventually ended up cracking this, was this mother calling the police and telling them what was going on. Her son Tyson Proper has been charged with conspiracy and firearms crimes, and several others have been taken to custody, as I mentioned. So now you're going to start seeing some of those alleged attackers go to court. Meanwhile, speaking of, we told you yesterday that Luigi Mangione's legal team was planning to use the psychiatric defense in his New York murder trial. Now they're pulling it back. So they're withdrawing that plan. The defense had said that he was suffering from extreme emotional disturbance when he shot and killed UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in 2024. And the decision is significant. Why? Because a psychiatric defense would require Mangione to concede that he killed Brian Thompson, which, you know, we should use the word allegedly, although it is on camera everywhere. But that would have lowered, if this were to have worked for the defense team, it would have lowered his conviction from a murder charge to a manslaughter charge. And so now with that off the table, Mangione has pleaded not guilty, and now he'll go to a September trial without that argument on the table, which is fascinating when you consider the high profile nature of that case. I mean, you're obviously not right when you've got a gun, a 3D printed gun, and you go and shoot somebody in cold blood. But as a matter of defense in a court of law, that might not have worked so well, and that's part of the reason why they decided to pull this back. Also, the University of Michigan athletic director Ward Manuel says the school is exploring new ways to generate revenue for NIL, including in-stadium advertising and corporate patches on jerseys. Now, I know a lot of true blue, old-school Michigan fans that would not be excited about this.
How do you feel about it?
I don't like it.
Okay. Well, I know you're a dyed-in-the-wool,
I'm a Michigan fan.
Michigan fan.
Yes.
That's why I asked.
It pains my Spartan alumnus wife every time that comes up. I don't know how she puts up with it, but she does. God bless her. But this is not generally how Michigan is operated. There is no advertising in the stadium. There is no patches. There is nothing like that. I mean, I remember when people were losing their minds when they were going to put the Big Ten logo on the jersey. People were upset about that.
I remember that.
And so the fact that you're going to put, you know, a company's logo on the jersey,
yeah,
that's going to anger some folks. And it's already started. I've seen it on social media. But Ward Manuel says the idea here is to generate revenue, and the college landscape is changing. And this money would go for all 29 varsity sports. And he says that it would help them remain competitive. But it really is a new era. And there's only so much that you can depend on boosters and fundraising and people donating money as a way to keep your NIL coffers full. But at the same time, This would be a pretty big change, certainly. Meanwhile, 712, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
What about the sloganeering about proud to be an American?
Okay, what about this idea? Are you proud to be an American? Extremely or very proud to be an American? Again, look at this divide, a growing divide on this question. Back in January of 2001, 90% of Republicans, 85% of Democrats. This was after a very contentious 2000 election, keep in mind, right, with George W. Bush coming into the White House. You come over to this side of the screen in 2026, look at this. Again, the Democratic percentage absolutely plummets to just 29% of Democrats say they're extremely or very proud to be an American. That Republican percentage, the exact same, 90 and 90. The Democratic percentage, what is that? That's basically a third of the level that it was just 25 years ago.
So how is that possible? How have we fallen so far? And maybe it's Democrats, but that's Harry Enten on CNN, one of their data polling experts. And Republicans holding steady in the span of 25 years, that 90% of Republicans say they are proud to be Americans and they have that national pride. Well, Democrats have fallen from 85% in 2021 to just 29% in 2026. And as we approach this 250th anniversary of our country, this birth of our nation, there is an identity crisis because for some reason, some Americans feel less unified around this idea of patriotism or religion or just at the very foundational level, a national purpose. Melissa Deckman is the CEO of Public Religion Research Institute and joins us this morning to talk about it. Melissa, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
What is the reason that we're seeing the numbers that we are? Why aren't people proud or patriotic about this country anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a new study out. I would encourage folks to go online and read it. But we ask those same questions about American pride, about the state of the nation, and who we want to be as a nation moving forward. And I think it's no secret that we live in a very polarized time. Partisanship, unfortunately, has been a very big dividing factor when it comes to how Americans view things. And I think that's also spilling over into concepts about, you know, why we aren't or are not proud of being Americans. And, you know, in terms of not just being Americans writ large, but, you know, looking at our economic achievements, looking at the way democracy is working, we see, you know, Americans, and the last feature, the way that democracy is working, you know, very few Americans, only 18% are extremely or very proud of the way democracy is working. So I think the mood of the country when it comes to patriotism is really explained by polarization that we're seeing and a deep unhappiness with, you know, how government is performing in society.
You know, I do wonder, too, I mean, for younger folks, and I like to count myself among them, although, you know, sometimes I have these intrusive thoughts of, you know, we've generally had it easy for the better part of decades, right? Yes, there is conflict. Yes, there was the war on terror. Yes, many people died. But, I mean, when you're talking about a World War II, World War I, these massive conflicts, even going back to the Cold War to a certain extent, I mean, we haven't had these major global international conflicts. So people tend to get a little lax. And then as you get further and further from these major issues, like younger people today, I don't know that they totally understand what has happened in order to get them to the place where they can endlessly scroll through TikTok or have a platform to speak their voice.
I think that's a good point. You know, I think the last time in modern history where we had a national unifying experience is 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you think about younger people in particular, you know, Gen Z, for example, you know, was not really around or has no memory of that. So there's no sense of a collective, you know, notion or event bringing us together in ways maybe historically that we've had. I think one finding in particular is really interesting and germane here. We asked Americans about whether they think the American dream, if you work hard, you'll get ahead, still holds true. And we're split on that as a country, 49% to 50%, right? Really half and half on that point here. But one of the things you'll notice generationally is that older Americans are far more likely to believe in the dream. And I think it speaks to what you're saying is that their kind of experience has always been one of upward mobility, of new opportunity. And there's so much uncertainty happening, you know, in society that younger people are really much more skeptical. In fact, we found a 14-point decline among young Americans aged 18 to 29 in terms of believing in the American dream, even from 2 years ago, from 50% down to 36%. And so I think the negative, there's a real negative sense in the country of where we're headed, and it spilled over into sort of our thoughts about pride in the country and an opportunity ahead.
So then how do we get back to that point?
Oh, that's sort of, you know, I think the million-dollar question, right? You know, I like to point to some things in our survey that maybe give us a little bit of hope for optimism. So one of those, I think, is that, you know, we're a nation that still supports the idea of pluralism by and large. And what that means is that we'd like to be a country, most Americans say, not all, of course, we're divided by party and other things and religion on this measure, but we'd like to be in a country that looks diverse religiously and racially. And so I think that's something that's positive, right? So there's still, I think, a concept that everyone, most people belong here, right? And I think that's a good thing. We also ask about characteristics of being a true American, like what characteristics are important. And so, you know, believing in the Constitution and individual freedoms, respecting political institutions, have broad measures of support, you know, by almost all Americans. And I think that's something to think about as we're, you know, and also being accepting of people of diverse racial and religious backgrounds. You know, very large majorities of Americans agree with that. So I think, you know, if we can kind of call to our better angels, be more inclusive, kind of have a society that really, I think, appreciates, you know, the contributions of all Americans, I think that would help. But it's a challenge these days, certainly.
Yeah, certainly. Melissa Deckman, thank you for your time this morning and talking about your poll. We appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah. My pleasure.
Yeah. You, the other part, too, in this is, I tend to push back on this idea that the politicalization of our national politics plays a role here. Of course it does. Of course it does. What I think most younger people don't realize is that this is finite. Like, this is, if you are dissatisfied with the way the government is running and you are opposed to this, and that is what is causing or coloring your perception on the American dream or whether you should be proud to be an American, these things are finite. There is going to be a day when Donald Trump isn't president. And if you are on board, if you're one of the people that love the way that our politics are being handled, or you like the direction of where we are going, well, of course you're going to be proud. But I point you to some of the discussion that Lloyd and I had yesterday about people that are coming here from around the world, from the Netherlands, from Denmark, from Scotland and England and Australia and all of these different places. And they go, oh my God, this place is unbelievable. This place is unbelievable. This is not at all what I thought America was. So, you know, sometimes you don't know what you got until somebody else points it out, and I think that's probably pretty apropos here. Coming up, we'll get you caught up on some of the national headlines. Also, some interesting comments by the Supreme Leader in Iran. We'll talk about it. It's JR Morning. So, some interesting comments by Iran's Supreme Leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, as he said yesterday that he authorized direct talks with the United States, but that they don't necessarily foresee an agreement with Washington, that there is not a signal there that shows that they're going to get a major deal done. This came as in a written statement on the Telegram channel, which is, of course, a state-run television station in Iran. And he said that he had been waiting for, or negotiators that were waiting for, his public green light of this memorandum of understanding ahead of these planned talks today and tomorrow. But he, of course, has not been seen, by the way. Mojtaba Khamenei has not been seen. He was wounded in those initial strikes at his father's house in those first couple of days of the war. Nobody has seen or heard from him publicly. But in this written statement, he said he opposed the signing of the MOU with the U.S., but authorized it at the recommendation of the president and the head of the country's National Security Council. Based on the commitment given to me by the Honorable President, acting in his capacity as chairman of the Supreme National Security Council, on behalf of himself and other members to safeguard the rights of the Iranian nation and the axis of resistance, and his explicit acceptance of responsibility for doing so, I authorized it. However, it is self-evident that the in-person negotiations that will take place in the future will not mean acceptance of the enemy's position. He said the president acted out of concern and goodwill and claimed that the president and the rest of the officials who supported the deal said that if the American side seeks excessive concessions, they will not submit to them. So it's interesting to note that he had initially opposed this deal. He also said that Donald Trump signed the deal out of desperation, which we kind of covered yesterday. This idea of the president saying, well, you know, we might have been heading to a depression. And I'm only paraphrasing. But the economic impacts is something that potentially colored the president's perspective on this deal as well, because it's not the one that we had necessarily expected. At the same time, U.S. forces have lifted their blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, this is the condition of that memorandum of understanding between the U.S. and Iran over the next 60 days as they try to get to an actual part of the deal. You know, major thoroughfare, 20% of the world's oil comes through that area. And so now CENTCOM saying that that has been lifted. I got to tell you this. Brian yesterday was texting me, getting ready for the show. I was out bebopping around, running some errands, and I forgot my phone at home. First of all, what a terrible feeling that is. Terrible feeling. I literally, at one point, I was like, what would happen if I got a flat tire? Do I have to stand on the side of the road and wave my arms around and try to get somebody's...
I know, it's like you, a part of you is missing.
It was like leaving a hand
behind.
Correct. Yes. I'm like, I don't know what to do in this world without a phone. This is crazy. But I'm out running around, and I go to a store. And as I'm walking up, you know, there's like four people walking up together. Two of them were together. One lady was alone, and then it was me. Mm-hmm. And as we're walking up to the front door, the woman who was by herself was on her phone. And she, you know, when somebody kind of like speeds up, because there's going to be a log jam, right? Somebody's got to speed up. Somebody's got to slow down. No, you go. Go ahead. It's okay. Yeah. All right. Go ahead. And you do that awkward dance for a minute.
Yeah.
Well, the woman on the phone just picked up her speed to try to get in first. All right. Didn't have much of a problem with it. Although I think generally my modus operandi is to dial it back. Let somebody else go first.
Sure.
Right? Okay. Yeah. That's fine. But as she walks in, it was a Target. So you mm-hmm. walk in the first set of doors, and then you walk in the second set of doors, right? So she's on her phone walking in, and as soon as she picks up her speed so she's going to get in first, powers it down. Powers it way down. And now she's walking slow. So as she's walking through the door, she's hot-dogging it. And as she walks to the second set of doors, she's hot-dogging it. And now there's two more people behind me. And I'm like, okay, it's fine.
Deep breath. Yeah.
So we are all going to get a cart. Everybody's veering over to the right to get a cart. And she's on her phone standing now just next to the carts. So nobody can get a cart. And I'm looking around for some sympathy, maybe.
Right.
Just yeah. Like, are we all seeing this? We're all on the same page. And of course, I'm never going to be the one to be like, hey, lady, let's pick it up. Like, you know what I mean? That's not my thing. So she's standing there. And finally, the two people in front of me who came in behind her kind of went on this big loop to go and get a cart. Right, so they went and got a cart.
Yeah.
I followed suit. And as I was going, she grabbed the cart and started walking ahead. Now, I'm blocked from both the carts and moving forward as she stops again. And now I check my watch, my blood pressure's rising. Things are going in the wrong direction for me. Things are going in the wrong direction.
Oh yeah.
And then you know, she finally moves. But, like, this felt like an eternity. It was probably, you know.
Yeah, just a minute
30,
or so.
40
yeah,
seconds.
Not even a minute.
Right?
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, like, this happens all the time. It happens all the time. And I'll be honest. Like, we don't really grocery shop anymore. We just, ever since COVID, we just go online, we pick out what we need, and then we go pick it up.
Sure.
right?
Yeah, my mom does that.
Yeah, it's great. I absolutely love it. So I don't really experience this as much as I used to because I think the number one place where this happens is in the grocery store.
Oh, yes.
And you're in an aisle and somebody's just like, do I want the hot honey or do I want the regular honey? What do I want the Kroger brand or do I? It's like, yep, just pick one and move.
Yes.
just get going.
Yep.
And of course, the cart is at a 45 degree angle and, you know, okay. So I'm shopping, picking up some stuff, whatever I need. And I see her a couple different times in the store and she's still on the phone. Still doing the same stuff. Now, again, I'm never going to go up to somebody and go like, hey, just FYI, there's like 15 people behind you. Could you just move it a little bit? I would never do that. But I was thinking, like, this is a flaw. It's you have, because I didn't have my phone, so it was kind of freeing in a sense.
Yeah, it's nice.
Like, I couldn't check anything. I was completely held hostage by not having a phone.
By your life.
Right. The air smelled a little nicer. The flowers were more vibrant.
Yeah.
But I was just like, this happens all the time. And I think we're probably a bit desensitized to it. But this isn't New York. You know, in New York, that's just a way of life. Everybody is that way. But here in the Midwest, that's not how things are. People are generally kind and nice and bubbly. And they like,
well,
you should
have a little respect for others around you.
But none.
I know.
There is no common sense.
Why my wife won't grocery shop or shop with me anymore. Because I am the guy who will go, it's not a phone booth. You got to keep moving.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You got to keep moving here.
It makes a lot of sense. But like, there's no common courtesy.
No.
And again, this is not everybody. I'm painting with a broad brush.
Of course.
But when it happens, you're like, what is going on in this world?
There's nothing more frustrating than you're behind the person who seems to have just woken up and discovered they're in the grocery store. Oh, where am I at? And they're standing in the middle of the aisle. Oh, yeah. It is my pet peeve beyond all pet peeves. Like, I'm here. My wife gets it. I'm there to accomplish a mission. I'm not here to shop. I have a list. I get the list, and I get out. And if you get between me and what I'm getting for, if you're there too long, it's like, excuse me, I will shove you out of the way to get what I want.
Jesus.
I'm not here. Yeah. For a social hour, I'm here to attain my goals and get home.
I mean, one time I saw a guy looking at a bottle of salad dressing, and it was the same bottle.
Yeah.
He was, like, comparing the two. Like, just pick the left one and move on.
I also will not answer the phone if I'm in line in a store. I have a rule. Our boss, Steve Finitari, once called me, and I was in the store, and like 10 minutes later, like, dude, I'm sorry. I don't answer the phone if I'm in the store. I cannot be that guy.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing is I will, but I'm still very self-aware.
Yeah.
Like, you got to keep things moving.
Right.
I talk in a lower voice, even though I probably don't have to. Like, you just, there's like a,
well, how many
there's
times,
like a common set of rules that you need to follow. They're
have
unwritten.
Have you been in the store or you've been in the elevator and somebody starts talking and you assume they're talking to you and you talk back and then they give you the stink eye. It's like, wait a minute. You're talking out loud. I'm standing here. We're alone.
Yeah, they
have
like AirPods in.
You were starting a conversation with me.
Yeah. It's a wild world out there. 744, time for Automotive Views with Mike Martinez. It's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Learn more at MichiganBusiness.org. Well, there certainly seems to be some growing frustration on both sides of the border here in the city of Detroit and in Windsor about the Gordie Howe International Bridge not being opened yet. And an interesting piece by columnist extraordinaire Neil Rubin in the Detroit Free Press points that traffic patterns are shifting away from the Ambassador Bridge because people aren't happy that the Gordie Howe Bridge is not open, even though it's ready to be fully operational. And Neil Rubin joins us this morning to talk about it. Neil, good morning. It's good to have you. Neil, we got you? All right, well, we're going to work on getting Neil. But one of the things that he's focusing on, and we're going to connect with him in just a second, is, you know, Matty Maroon and the Maroon family own the Ambassador Bridge. And there are people, particularly on the Windsor side, that feel like he is an obstacle, that the political nature of this and the now delaying of this new project is what is causing the consternation on both sides. And then, of course, you've got, you know, former Governor Rick Snyder, who's been paramount in all of this, approved this way back when. And now we're at the finish line, and yet still no cars crossing. Neil Rubin is on the other end of our line. I understand it. Neil, good morning.
Technology is wonderful.
Isn't it great? Isn't it great? It's great when it works. It's a real pain when it doesn't. Let's talk about this piece. Obviously, you know, the fact that it's done, I think, provides just a little extra ribbing here. But there does seem to be a change in the way people are making that commute across this crossing now.
They are. It's a combination of frustration with the bridge is all finished. It's got a nice, pretty bow on it. We can't unwrap it. What the heck is going on with that? And frankly, particularly on the part of Canadians, it's anti-Trump sentiment. Mm-hmm. And to exacerbate things, you know, let's face it, the Maroon family has always been a convenient villain, frequently deserved that title. But then the bridge is closed and, you know, Matthew Maroon wrote a $1 million check in January to the MAGA Incorporated PAC. And now they can't get the bridge open, and it's not very difficult to connect those dots.
Sure, and this idea of now almost like Canadians that would be coming across the border, they'll use the tunnel, or they're trying to stay away from the Ambassador Bridge almost. I guess we kind of got okey-doked, Neil. I mean, we were told that there was going to be a ribbon cutting and that the bridge was going to be open last week, and then those plans obviously folded. Have you heard where we're at on the opening of this thing? Like, how close are we?
Well, it sort of could be any day as soon as the U.S. governmental side signs off. Like you were saying, the bridge is completed. The announcement was sort of weird of the opening.
It was.
I mean, you would think we would know weeks in advance and there'd be the Goodyear blimp and marching bands. And it was suddenly, oops, hey, it's going to be Tuesday. Wait, what? I got to get my suit back from the cleaner. And then 3 days later, wait, never mind. We were just kidding. There's no opening. But to what you were saying, yes, absolutely. The bridge, for lots of reasons, despite its high prices, has been the dominator in commercial traffic and regular traffic. And it's been passed by the Blue Water Bridge up in Port Huron and the tunnel. And that's an absolute, you can't read it any other way. That's an absolute reaction to what's going on with the Gordie Howe.
You pointed out that the tunnel moved 3.74 million cars in 2025. That was almost 200,000 more than the Ambassador Bridge. Seemed like they're on pace to beat that again through the first quarter or so of the year.
They're going to crush it. And that's despite, for instance, Henry Ford Health System has 1,600 employees who live in Windsor and Essex County. They've got to go somewhere. And the sense is that even if you live south of Windsor and you're coming up, you pass the bridge to get to the tunnel. You're inconveniencing yourself because you're so steamed about this. It's even more stark at the Blue Water Bridge. In 2023, the Ambassador Bridge did 800,000 more trucks than the Blue Water. And last year, the Blue Water did more than the Ambassador.
Mm. So do you think this is political? Do you think it's just economics at this point? Is it some combination of both?
Combination. I think you've hit on it. Largely political. Canadians, we used to be best pals, and now the president of the United States is talking about, annexing Canada as the 51st state. He's calling the prime minister governor, being deliberately belittling. At the same time, the Blue Water is significantly cheaper to cross if you're driving a semi than the Ambassador is. Lets you know how much money there is in this, even with the lower total.
Right.
1.9 million commercial crossings of the Ambassador Bridge last year. Well, the toll for that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I think it just shows that people want this other bridge open. Neil, we're up against it. I appreciate your time as always. Thanks for chatting. We'll talk again soon.
Great, thanks. Yeah,
you got it. 8 o'clock hour next on JR Morning. 8 o'clock hour. Good to have you here on a Friday. And there is just so much going on. One of them is, obviously, the memorandum of understanding that's in place triggers this 60-day now negotiating period where a deal is hopefully on the horizon between the United States and Iran. What we do know is that, at least from my perspective, the deal was not what I expected. But regardless, it's not the final deal. So we'll save final judgment until a final deal gets done. But we do know that there is some real pressure back home in Washington as to what this deal means and what it means to other lawmakers that would certainly be in the president's corner. Because while this starts hopefully the process of getting to a deal, Republicans want more details before they fully support this. The president said that the deal had already been signed by all parties, but senators, including the Senate Majority Leader John Thune, who's obviously the leader of the Senate, member of the Gang of Eight, he gets top intel before the rest of Congress, gets that briefing from the administration. But he still doesn't quite exactly know what all of this means or what everything is included in this memorandum of understanding. He said, I don't even think the people who follow this stuff closely up here know much about it. I don't know whether it's the vice president for sure. Our members are going to have a lot of questions about it. And he said, when asked if the vice president should brief senators on the matter, he said somebody will need to. So whether that's the vice president, whether that's somebody else in the administration, he doesn't know. You've got John Kennedy, the senator out of Louisiana. History shows that the religious zealots running Iran lie like fish swim. I love the euphemisms that he talks in all the time. It's real fun. Chuck Schumer, we've been told dozens of times that this war is over. Dozens of times we've been disappointed. There have been divergent statements from a variety of people in the administration in these high stakes negotiations. The devil's in the details, but Trump still hasn't revealed the text of the understanding with Iran. So, sure, not a surprise there from Chuck Schumer, but it is interesting that you have Republicans that are saying, well, hold on a second. We don't know exactly what this is yet. And the negotiations are ongoing, certainly. And we've got, you know, just now under 60 days to get this done. But it does provide a cloudy outlook to what could be coming for this deal. Then you've got the supreme leader of Iran, Mashaba Khamenei, saying, well, by the way, nobody has seen him. Nobody has seen him since his elevation to supreme leader. They think that he is injured, disfigured, whatever, but nobody has seen him. And he released a statement to Iran Run TV and basically said, you know, the president of Iran said this was a good deal. I was opposed to it. He says it's a good deal. He's sticking his neck out on the line. So I signed off on it. He also said that he did initially oppose this deal, that this was not one that he would have agreed to. But because others in the regime did, he went on board with it. He also said that Donald Trump made this agreement out of desperation. That while the blockade in the Strait of Hormuz, according to CENTCOM, has been lifted. So we are going to get more traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, which is a good thing. But again, what this means for a final deal, because the text that we have shows that it can get a little unclear as to what happens after that 60 days, if there isn't an extension in those conversations, what happens after those 60 days when a deal is maybe done? Are there going to be tolls between Iran and Oman in getting people through the Strait of Hormuz? We don't know exactly yet, but again, this is a memorandum of understanding. It is not a final deal. I find it interesting as well, because obviously our intelligence that we have, not abroad, here on the homeland, with federal investigators, federal intelligence, you would think that if there is something high profile being planned, that it's on the radar. Interesting story out of ABC News, because that threat to the UFC event at the White House over the weekend, that investigation may have been triggered by one of the mothers of the suspects. A mother in Ohio called in to a local law enforcement who's a relative and talked with local dispatchers because she became alarmed by her 19-year-old son's behavior. There were concerns about weapons. There was concerns about ammunition, his mindset. And so she decided to call law enforcement. Deputies came to the house. Mother said, go into his room. That's where everything is, guns, ammunition. And that is what ended up triggering this wider investigation. This initial tip is what led federal authorities to identify this scheme of putting explosives on drones, flying them over the UFC event. And then as people were scattering in fear and running for their lives, you would have snipers in various locations picking people off. But it all started with a concerned mother who was at least had the wherewithal to notice that something was wrong with her son and called police. Because ultimately, what would have happened here? This would this have flown under the radar of the FBI? It's certainly a scary thought. University of Michigan Athletic Director Ward Manuel saying the school is exploring new ways to generate revenue for NIL, including in-stadium advertising and corporate patches on jerseys. The AD is saying that Michigan is looking at highly visible but thoughtfully integrated options like field logos or scoreboard ads or sponsorships or patches on uniforms. And this would help fund all 29 university sports that they will remain competitive in this completely Wild West era of college athletics. And of course, Michigan has been a traditional university. They don't have advertising. They try to keep all of that out of in the stadium. You know, obviously you got stuff on the concourse or whatever, but inside the stadium where you're sitting in those seats and looking out onto the field, there's nothing. But in the world of NIL, when you need to have some sort of money generator to stay relevant, this is certainly a break in tradition for the University of Michigan. Some people are already upset about it. Others are going to say, well, who cares? Honestly, if at the end of the day, as fans, you want to win, does it really matter if you've got a name of a heating and cooling company up on the scoreboard? That's certainly a new age way of thinking about it. Also, Tigers getting ready to take on the White Sox tonight. 3-game home series. Tarek Skubal gets the bump. Tigers 30-44. They're 18-16 at home. The White Sox 15-22 when they're on the road. They've played pretty well this year. And yes, Jason. What are you doing? It's a big series, and it kicks off with Skubal tonight, trying to break that 2-game losing streak. Yeah, he's pretty good. He's got something working. Coming up on the other side, we are awaiting 3 o'clock this afternoon. Team USA getting back after it against Australia. Is Christian Pulisic going to play? Do you know who that is? We're talking football on the other side. It's JR Morning. All right, so the U.S. back in action this afternoon, 3 o'clock in Washington, Seattle at Lumen Field. They take on Australia, and these are two very different teams. And again, I don't want to break down these games because I don't know how many of you are diehard soccer fans, but if there's ever a time to be a soccer fan, it's right now. Right now is the time. And whether Christian Pulisic is going to be able to go today, we'll see. But a pretty different contrasting styles between the United States and Australia. Australia, you'll likely see they'll sit back. They're willing to defend and they'll hit you on a long break. I think they only had 9 shots on goal in their first game. The United States is much more aggressive. So 2 contrasting styles, but we'll see how that pans out at 3 o'clock this afternoon on Fox. Also, Canada putting a beat down yesterday, 6-0. They look pretty good. And as we talk all about the games, but it's the periphery, it's the fans, it's the excitement from people all around the world that are coming here to the United States and in North America and taking it all in. Keith Baldwin is the owner of the Regal Eagle. It's the place to catch all these games and joins us this morning. Keith, it's good to have you back.
Good morning. How are you doing?
We're well. You know, the Pulisic stuff is worrying me a little bit, but I'm taking deep breaths in the break. So that's how I'm regulating. First of all, I have to ask you, have you run into the same problems that some of these bars in Boston have? Thankfully, we don't have a huge Scottish contingency here because they have been drinking these bars dry. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's been a fun story to watch all these bar owners. And yeah, we have, because we are in Mexican Town on the edge of Southwest, and we have a big Modelo bar.
Okay.
And this first week, I was scrambling to get extra Modelo, but then we just got that order. We ordered 100 cases of Modelo alone, and last night was epic for the Mexican team.
Yes.
We went through a lot of those cases, and it's a big week, and the bars nationwide, everyone is up.
That's
everywhere.
That's so great. It's great to hear. How have things been going? I have to imagine, you know, in a place like yours at the Regal Eagle, the excitement is sky high.
It's sky high. We've opened the extra back area. We were packed to capacity last night. It was an amazing atmosphere. People there for the Mexico and the Canada game. I mean, Canada getting their first ever World Cup victory, and then the excitement with the Mexico win, as we were absolutely packed last night. It was fantastic.
Yeah, Jonathan David for Canada has got 3 goals. Lionel Messi had the hat trick in that game just a few days ago. What have you made of the game so far? Because I think you were kind of getting what we want in terms of, you know, the all-stars, the best players in the world are really coming through.
Yeah, I think this World Cup, even though it's only a week old, will be remembered as a transformational World Cup that's hit the ground running. The way soccer's being played is almost going to be changed forever with these hydration breaks. We've turned a game of 2 halves into a game of quarters, and they're never going to go away in these tournaments. And people have started strong, like you mentioned. Sometimes you wait for the stars to get going. Messi got a hat-trick, Mbappe 2 goals, Haaland 2 goals, Kane 2 goals. I mean, it's straight away this World Cup is delivering.
I was going to ask you about the hydration breaks. And part of the reason they were installed here is because of just the humidity or the temperatures. Is they wanted to give them an opportunity to regroup and just take that hydration break. But it's turned into an opportunity for the coaching staffs to get things right. If they see something that they want to make an adjustment to midway through the first half or midway through the second half, they can. Do you think that's here to stay?
It's here to stay in the tournament for 2 reasons. One, it is needed because of the heat. You know, so it truly is needed. And then the next World Cup in 4 years is in Spain, Morocco, and Portugal, mm-hmm. and that's pretty hot too. So, and the second reason it's here to stay, a lot of countries, including America, are showing ads. And I read how, like, Fox paid $485 million for the rights to show the games, and they're making over $250 million just from the ads and the hydration break. So for so many reasons, it's a boom. It's needed because of the heat, and it's just not going to go away in these tournaments now. I mean, it does change the game a bit, but it's funny. You know, some people might want the hydration break to reset, but some of the teams haven't drastically changed. It's not making that much of a coaching difference, mm-hmm. but it is making a difference still.
It's funny. I was, because I'm curious if you think it's going to switch over to club play, because to your point, right, in terms of the coaching decisions, they are able to regroup and talk things over, but we haven't seen drastically different game plans out of those breaks. But at the same time, do you think it could bleed over into club play, or do you think they keep it as 2 halves?
It's going to stay as two halves, especially in many, many countries. There are rules in place, meaning that you can't change the format like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even in England, they're not showing ads during those hydration breaks.
But okay.
It doesn't mean it won't creep in at some stage, maybe in hotter climates as well.
Interesting. What has been your impression of the fans that have come over and to take these games in? I mean, social media is all over the place with people that have come in and talked about, being down in Texas or being in Florida or New England or New York or L.A. I mean, the reception here has been exceptional.
Yeah, it's been a big party. You see it on social media. Communities find each other as well. Like, we've had fans from every country for every game down at the Regal Eagle. We had a great group supporting Congo the other day. And it's, you know, cool. The Scottish obviously are making a lot of noise and they're doing well. The English are doing well. I mean, everyone from everywhere is meeting, getting together. You've seen the big meetups in the parks in Dearborn. It's one yeah. big international celebration.
What is who has surprised you the most through these early games?
The USA was a surprise. I thought they would do well, but the way they absolutely dominated the whole game, that was a bit of a surprise, and they really set the bar very high. But with all the first games of the World Cup, they mean something, but they don't mean too much. Like, mm-hmm. Argentina, last World Cup, lost the first game to Saudi Arabia, and then they won the whole thing.
Right.
It's now, this week, you're really starting to get into it. Game two, and then starting Wednesday, it's game three for groups that's really going to decide who's moving on to the knockout rounds and who's going home.
And these, once you start getting into who's moving on, the knockout rounds, those are when I think this thing takes a whole other life. Like, it's a party now, everybody's having fun. And then once your team gets through, everybody gets a little tighter, everybody gets a little more excited, but it certainly all adds to the element of these games. We're so happy that things are going well at the Regal Eagle. Keith Baldwin, thank you for your time as always. We'll talk again hopefully next week as we get some more exciting matchups on the horizon.
All right. Thanks very much.
Yep.
And go USA today.
That's exactly right. Go USA. Keith Baldwin, the owner of the Regal Eagle. We appreciate your time. Coming up on the other side, Jamie Edmonds hops on the show. We're talking about her latest episode of her podcast, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. It's next here on JR Morning. All right, welcome back. Good to have you here on a Friday. Kevin Dietz coming your way at 9 o'clock. But Jamie Edmonds hopping back on the show this morning because the new episode of her podcast is out, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way. Good morning, Jamie.
Hey, Chris. How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm okay. You know what? I'm managing the side effects. I'm okay. I only have two more treatments left.
Two more treatments of the Red Devil?
Yes, the perfect scary name that yeah, this thing has.
They really should lighten that up a little bit.
Well, you know, it's not the medical community. This is like a nickname.
I'm glad you didn't walk into your doctor's office and go, "All right, ready for the Red Devil?" Yeah.
No, actually, I did, but yeah.
Well, fair. Yeah. So things are going well?
You know, they're going okay. I'm managing it, and it's going okay. Knock on wood. Everybody yeah. knock on wood.
Yes.
Thank
Good.
You.
Yes, I got you. So the new episode of the podcast is out.
Yeah, so I've started a little offshoot that when I have the person available and ready to go on Tuesdays, I'm calling it Touched by Cancer. So it mm-hmm. can be sort of anyone just touched by cancer. And in that realm, I've had Dave Coulier talking about his cancer, and I had a mom of two teenage daughters who had colon cancer that came up on her very first test at 45 years old. So she and I talk on the pod, and she really likes Sam LaPorta, and we had Sam LaPorta surprise her on the pod. So that was
really
awesome.
Fun. That's awesome. That's awesome. I haven't seen that one yet. The Dave Coulier one was excellent. Obviously a high profile case that he had. And I like this offshoot of discussing just cancer more broadly with other people that have been going through it.
Well, so many people have been touched by it. So unfortunately, there's not a lack of folks out there to talk to. So that's what I've been doing on Tuesdays, if I have the person, not mm-hmm. every Tuesday. And then Thursdays is still Angels Along the Way. And yesterday, my angel Vina, who is a hairstylist, but also a triple negative breast cancer survivor, She has a salon here in Grosse Pointe. She's the one who shaved my head. So it was very emotional. We talk about the nitty gritty. We both cry, but we both laugh too. She's hilarious.
And again, like the thing that I love about this is you're highlighting everything that is tied to this or attached to this scourge of a disease that you're highlighting it. And again, the appearance, the physical appearance is something that everybody goes through.
Yes. And I did a post on Instagram. I wasn't going to put my bald head out there, but I thought I'm putting it all out there. Why not? This is something that I'm going through. And I've gotten so many messages again on social media. And my most favorite one is that this person sent me a message, and she's local to Metro Detroit, and she's been diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic triple negative breast cancer. She's 31. She's got 2 young girls. And she just says, like, the pods and the Instagrams have been so informative, and she likes listening to the story, which was my hope. Because when I was in the very dark time initially, I really enjoyed watching stories from other people going through it. So if I can be that for other people, happy to do it.
Yeah, that's great. How's the family? Everybody good?
Yeah, everyone's well. Olivia is thriving. She's having a wonderful summer. She told me she wishes it were a little warmer outside.
I mean, preach, Olivia.
Yeah, we're okay. We're surviving. We're thriving. We're getting through this. And I'm just so grateful to all the messages I've got from people.
Yeah. And I love your dad. I mean, you've included everybody in these, you know, posts and pictures and things like that. I love when you include your dad and just everybody that's, you know, that everybody that's in your corner. I love that you're highlighting them too.
Well, dad comes a lot. I've always been a daddy's girl, and I still am at 43 years old. So he's come a lot. And you know what we're planning for, Chris? And it's just so exciting to say it. We're planning for the bell ringing day and who's going to come and who, and you know what I asked the nurses on the floor? I'm like, how many people are allowed to come? Because honestly, they've been surprised by my tribe that has come to support me. It's like a different person every time I go. So I had to ask for a number. I haven't gotten the official number yet.
Wait, do we need to put out like a Ticketmaster sign up just to see?
Let's
if
move
we can...
this to the Fox Theater. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
right, exactly.
Just kidding.
Well, good. I'm glad you're managing, and again, you know, feeling okay through all of this. That's good.
Yeah, I'm feeling okay. I think the sunshine helps. I think the warmer weather is helping. It's good for the soul. As Dave Coulier and his wife said, go outside, touch grass.
Yeah,
that's real. And I'm doing the best I can. I do miss you guys. How are you?
Good. Yeah. You know, we're chugging along here. We're, you know, in the process of moving and getting all of that out of the way. And, you know, we're trying to wrap up the baseball season here with the kids. And so, yeah, things are good. Things are good.
Okay, good. I haven't been on the radio with Lloyd since he turned 60. So I thought I'd be able to wish him a happy birthday.
I know
he's listening.
Yeah, he's off today. He's going to visit his daughter down in the greater Columbus area. So he's going to go see her. Let me ask you this, because we've got a big football match today. Are you dialed into the World Cup?
As dialed in as I can be. I pop in every 4 years.
Right.
Like, I'm like, okay, I'm a soccer fan. Who's the guy that is it Balogun? That's the guy I like now.
Okay, fair. What about Mbappe?
No.
Okay, good.
No, out. I like
Messi and Ronaldo and all those guys?
No, I'm just following our team.
Oh, just our team.
I want the USA to win it all.
Good. So, well, yeah. I mean, they had a nice showing. Although Christian Pulisic might be banged up here. That's a problem.
Why won't they? Will not say.
They won't say.
What's going on with him?
No, it's very cloak and dagger. Although,
and the,
maybe it's, hopefully it's nothing. Maybe they're just trying to throw Australia a curveball.
Who do you think sort of fakes these injuries better with the acting? The NBA or these soccer players?
Oh, that's a good question. Who fakes
it's
them
unbelievable.
Better? No, I mean, soccer's got to fake them better. I mean, they've been doing it for longer. The
Probably.
Flopping is a relatively new phenomenon in the NBA. I mean,
when
some of the flops in the NBA
on slow-mo,
are...
Yes. It's so embarrassing.
Yes. Well, then they bring out the magic water bottle and they squirt the injury and everything's fine after that.
Right. Well, go USA. I will be watching.
All right, go Jamie. We love you.
Thank
you. Glad you're feeling well. We'll talk
love
soon.
Love you too.
All right.
Bye.
That's Jamie Edmonds. We'll take a break. More coming up. Elmer's on the move. We'll tell you who that is and where he's going next on JR Morning. Well, Elmer is going to find a new home. a long time Elmer's been at Oakland Community College, but the new home, the Cranbrook Institute of Science. And Elmer is a mastodon skeleton, and he was found in incredible condition back in the late 60s, 1968. A third of Elmer's bones were discovered at a construction site at M59 between Elizabeth Lake and Williams Lake Road in White Lake. And once they ended up finding it, obviously there was an excavation underway, and Elmer has lived at OCC for many, many years. But now the new home is Cranbrook. And of course, it's fantastic news. Lucy Hales, the director of the Cranbrook Institute of Science, and Peter Provisano, the chancellor for Oakland County Community College, joins us. It's so good to talk to you both. Peter, let's start with you, the good steward that you have been and the school has been for so long, having Elmer under your roof. What a fantastic job of highlighting him and keeping him in such wonderful shape all these years.
Yeah, I mean, this is a partnership we're really excited about. By the way, good to hear from you again, Chris. And I was listening earlier today, and I saw Jamie's doing really great.
Yes,
so Jamie's
she
doing
is.
Great, so that's great to hear. Yeah, that's awesome. But yeah, we're really excited about this partnership. And it's one of those things where when we first made the announcement that we're moving our health sciences to a newly renovated facility in Farmington Hills, one of the first questions I received was, what are you going to do with Elmer? And we promised to find a great home for him. And originally we thought we would build brand new exhibit space in our new building. But we wanted to find a way to do this where we could really enhance the way we've been educating the community. And that's what's exciting about this partnership with Cranbrook. It allows us to do exactly that, but at scale. So you've got thousands of people at Cranbrook that OCC will be able to tell Elmer's story to now.
And Lucy, that's got to be exciting for you too.
Yeah, we're so excited. It helps open us up to a whole new audience, and it's really helped develop a great, you know, budding partnership with OCC, which has been really exciting to explore, and to meet everyone there has been wonderful.
So let's talk a little bit about the process of a move like this. We just sold our house and we're moving our stuff. It's easy to put things in boxes and have some loaded onto a truck. That's not really how you move a mastodon, though. How does this get done?
No, imagine if you were like very carefully.
Yeah.
Imagine, Chris, if you were like, I love my staircase, I'm taking it with me.
Right.
That's sort of, yeah. And as Peter mentioned, very carefully. So we have, you know, scaffolding and cherry pickers, different types of equipment that will be going up next week on Monday. And several team members from our exhibits and collections teams will be there to deinstall Elmer. And it is... You know, the installation that happened in the 1980s, we don't have plans of that, but we did find, Peter, this is, I don't think I've even told you this. We found the book from the National Geographic book that Elmer was in, and there's some incredible photos in there that do show his construction, which was really helpful
for our team.
Yeah, that's to great. Understand kind of how some of that metal aperture is put together. So they'll be, you know, undoing bolts and really carefully removing pieces of bone and pieces of plaster, that the parts of him that are recreated, and every piece will get carefully wrapped and then put into a vehicle and brought over to the Institute at the end of every day. And he will go into our fossil prep lab at the Institute of Science at Cranbrook for storage and renovation and restoration. And then he'll be on exhibit. He'll get, we'll build out a new aperture for him, and he'll get put on exhibit, the hope is next summer at the Institute.
Well, and Peter, to that point, one of the things that you've talked about is more eyes being on Elmer and the mm-hmm. wonder of these great beasts that once, you know, roamed the earth and having that accessibility and this new facility in Farmington Hills is one that is obviously very exciting for OCC. But, having Elmer in your repertoire has to be pretty exciting, and just the stewardship of making sure that the next generation can experience this too in a different way. That's pretty selfless.
You know, it really is, but it's all about just focusing on the community. I mean, the community is so important to us, and it's our way of really adapting to a changing world and taking advantage of opportunities that that come along. And so while we still own Elmer, and he's on loan, it's a long-term loan. And it's really, like I said, about the community and finding ways for the community to learn more about Elmer. And I think something that's really interesting that's been, I see, an unintended consequence of this partnership is that, you know, Cranbrook had a lot of information. They knew about Elmer. We had information about Elmer. But you could see by coming together, we're sharing that information. And so I think this is just going to be a better exhibit now with these two amazing organizations coming together and really demonstrating that we're better together and we're better together for the community.
Yeah, certainly. Well, it's fantastic. It's a wonderful way to honor Elmer. Yeah, certainly. What kind of background setting will Elmer be housed in, Lucy?
So he's going to be part of the Mastodons Did Not Survive exhibit that we have at Cranbrook, which is adjacent to our Ice Age exhibit. So it's a really nice flow of information and visitor experience. And so he will be behind a wall. If you've been to that exhibit, you know there's a wall of spear points. It's really beautiful with light wood. And he'll be sort of unveiled behind that wall. And so he will be next to Hezi, which is a, you know, scientifically accurate replica of what a mastodon may have looked like in real life. If you could imagine, if somebody was able to taxidermy a mastodon, that's what Hezi is. And Hezi is named after Dr. Shoshani, who taught the class that mounted Elmer back in the 1980s. And so it's a really nice way to honor Dr. Shoshani as well, who sadly passed away in 2008. And so Elmer will be a pretty cool reveal when you come around that wall to see him in that space. Currently, there's some taxidermy specimens of mammals that were around in the Ice Age that are still around today, and we'll find a new spot for those. We also will have some information. You know, we'll have information about the process of finding Elmer and putting Elmer together, and we'll also get to highlight OCC as a wonderful partner,
no doubt,
and community organization here in Oakland County.
Lucy and Peter, thank you both so much. Great stewards. Thank you for your time. We'll talk again very soon.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, a very cool story. Elmer on the move to Cranbrook. That's going to do it for us. Kevin Eats and All Talk coming up next. Have a good weekend. Happy Father's Day, too.